If you have your own story of being in a cult or a high control group, or if you've had an experience with manipulation or abuse of power you'd like to share, leave us a message on our hotline number at 513-900-2955.
Or shoot us an email at trustmepod@gmail.com.
Trust me.
Dude, you trust me.
Trust me. I'm like a smart person.
Yeah, I've never lied to you. I never have lied to you.
If you think that one person has all the answers,
don't.
Welcome to Trust Me, the podcast about cults, extreme belief, and the abuse of power from two mob wives who've actually experienced it. I am Lola Blanc.
And I am Megan Elizabeth.
And guess what? We're not really mob wives. But surprise. Maybe someday. You never know. Today, our guests are Sean Williams and Danny Gold, reporters and hosts of the Underworld podcast, which delves into all things organized crime. So these delightful fellas have reported on all kinds of international crime and have done deep dives on mafias worldwide on their podcast. And they're going to talk to us today about organized crime across the world.
We're going to talk about crime groups from Nigeria's Black Axe cult to the Burmese mafia, what organized crime has in common with cults, what groups they've been the most fascinated by and the reporting, and lots more.
All righty, stay tuned. Before we get into it, Megan, what's the coolest thing that's happened to you this week?
Well, I was a little out of it for this interview because I had gotten the vaccine, the second COVID vaccine.
Yay.
Yay. I've gotten some surprising pushback on it.
Really?
You know, we've already gotten in trouble on this podcast for being too political. So, you know, I know this is a very charged subject, but people that I didn't think would be against it were like, you shouldn't have done that. Yeah. So,
yeah. There's this like New York Times chat bot where you can select different answers, like multiple choice answers in a conversation with someone who's having hesitations about the vaccine. And it was really interesting because I think that our default response as people who are pro-vaccine does tend to be very, but what?
Yeah.
Science, you know, and that is very alienating to people.
Totally.
But it is really interesting. It was useful for me because I also have had people in my life who I was pretty surprised were having as many hesitations as they were. It's a thing, man. It's spreading. It's a thing. I understand some of the concerns, but some of the literature that's been going around to support those concerns is not coming from actual scientists. It's not coming from the medical community really at all. Yeah. Yeah. And anyway, if you are having concerns about the vaccine, I totally understand that. It is a, you know, it hasn't been around that long. I get why you would be concerned, but just so you know, the coronavirus has been studied for quite some time. Vaccine came out faster than it normally would because there was a lot of red tape that was removed for this process. And anyway, there are lots of reasons to get the vaccine. I would say, feel free to DM us.
Oh, yeah. Apparently Lola is like, it's her new job to talk to people about this. I did not know.
I don't know. I feel like it's important because I feel like my knee-jerk response would be to be like, what are you talking about? But like, that's not, you know,
right.
There are a lot of really reasonable people who are having concerns. So I feel like it's an important conversation to have.
Totally. Yeah. What about you? What's the coolest thing that happened to you this week?
It's just one YouTube video, really. But I didn't actually know what mentalist meant. I didn't really understand what that word meant.
Okay.
I guess it seemed like maybe a party. Maybe I kind of did, but it was vague in my head. Do you know what a mentalist is?
Well, you tell me because I thought I did, but now I don't anymore.
No, you probably do. It's like someone who uses tricks of psychology and priming processes to appear to be psychic, essentially, as a party trick.
Right.
So I was looking up this video.
I thought you were saying something about parties as in like political parties.
Oh, my God.
I was like, I guess I don't know what a mentalist is at all. Okay. Parties. Yes. Okay.
You know, Joe Biden's mentalist.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So I watched this guy who was on James Corden. And I'm going to spoil it for you guys. So if you don't want to know, you should skip this so you can go watch it for yourself. But it's crazy. This mentalist was on and everyone in the audience had like a little whiteboard to draw
I've
something on. Oh, you have? Yes. It's insane, right? Okay, well, I'm going to describe it for listeners.
Yeah.
So he has his guests and he has the band and then there's the audience and the mentalist guy, you know, he holds up his little whiteboard. Everyone's supposed to draw something. And he holds up his little whiteboards and he draws a couple of examples. He's like, here's a mountain and here's a whatever. And you know, you draw anything you want. Anything you want. Ready. Don't show your neighbor. Here we go. Go. And he asks one person in the audience to hold up their whiteboard. It's a star. He asks another person in the audience to hold up their whiteboard. It's a star. He has everyone in the audience, including the band and James Corden, hold up their whiteboard. And it's all a fucking star. Everyone drew a star. He got everyone to do it. And the way that he did it was he used priming. So his little test example drawings that he was holding up, they were drawings, but they spelled out star. They were all in the shape. So the mountain was an A because it was pointy. I forget what the other ones were. But that is how easy it is to put ideas into people's brains that they think are just coming from their own minds. Mm-hmm. It's so fascinating to me, especially because my girlfriend and I have been in a debate this whole week about free will. You know, I'm like pretty firmly on the side of we have no control over what thoughts come into our brain. Everything is just kind of random. And some people think that randomness means that free will exists, whatever. I'm not one of those people. I'm like, we're just a collection of impulses and responses and reactions. And mentalism 100% makes me think that I have chosen the correct stance on this issue. Mm-hmm. What was your, I mean, that video was crazy, right?
Yeah. The one I feel like I saw, it might have been a different time, but I think it was like an S that everybody drew, like some weird Superman S or something like that. But I think about it all the time. It's so fucking weird. And sometimes I'm like, was that faked? Because it's just so crazy that not one person was like, I'm going to draw a heart. Like everyone drew a star.
I know, it's insane. It's like priming, dude. And that makes me think about all other kinds of ways that you can manipulate people and ways that I can manipulate people. Not that I want to manipulate people, but when I think in terms of career, I'm like, oh, it makes sense how like your goal should always be to just stay in front of people, like stay in their minds, because then they'll think of you because there's that, you know, whatever they've seen most recently is what they'll think of
right
next. Whatever they're primed to think about is what they'll call up in their minds for the next project or whatever. But then also I'm like, how many fucking cult leaders are doing tricks like this and convincing people that it's because of their magical powers?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like a lot of the cult leaders that we've discussed so far are pretty on board thinking that they are magical. So I'm very curious about somebody who's just like full out, like that Steve Martin movie from the 80s where he's just faking it hard. I want to talk to somebody like that.
That's an interesting point. And you know, my old cult leader was absolutely just tricking people and was like aware of it and would go back and forth between saying that he was and saying that actually he was lying when he said he was tricking people to test your faith.
I can't with them.
But then also like Jim Jones, arguably Jim Jones probably believed his shit at the end because of the extreme measures that he took. But in the beginning, he was faking miracles. He had people faking their healing out of their wheelchair and shit, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. Like they were. So I'm like, how many of them are faking this, but then get so caught up in their own like deception
right.
that they begin to believe it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. We really need to interview an actual cult leader. Who's going to come on and lead us?
Give us your brain, you crazy person.
For realsies. Speaking of bad behavior, shall we talk to our guests, Sean and Danny, now?
Yes, let's do it.
Let's do it. Welcome, Sean Williams and Danny Gold.
Thank you for having us. We're thrilled to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming. So y'all are both journalists and you have a podcast together called The Underworld Podcast, which is also on our lovely home network, Podcast One. Shout out. Can you both say your names so we can tell the difference between your voices, please?
There is no difference, right? I am Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold.
It sounds too similar. I can't tell. Tell us a bit about your backgrounds to start so people just know who you are. Like, what kinds of stuff have you covered? What do you do? Give us the rundown.
Sean, you want to go?
Yeah, I'm a freelance journalist, features writer, part-time terrible photographer. I've been all over the place covering organized crime, conflict, human rights kind of stuff from Nigeria, Iceland, Philippines, Somalia, anywhere there's a problem with organized crime or people in trouble.
So noble.
You're the man.
Yeah, I've just covered a lot of bad things and chased around a lot of elusive and interesting, not necessarily good people, I guess.
Can relate. Okay.
I'm a reporter too. I started off doing your sort of breaking news crime stories around New York. And then transitioned to doing a lot of foreign reporting, first print places like, you know, Iraq, Syria, Turkey, Myanmar. And then I switched to documentaries and I worked at Vice for a while. And then, yeah, since then, I've just kind of done your run of the mill sort of chaos beat, you know, like anywhere. I've done like Ebola stories or stuff on Al-Qaeda or MS-13, gangs in St. Louis, a lot of stuff in El Salvador, Mexico, Trinidad, and just sort of bouncing around the world doing fun stuff like that.
So you two are the reason that when I open the news, I feel terror and utter horror at everything that happens in the world.
This is their fault. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. What do we say to that? Do we say, yes, you should feel terrified, or like, no, it's all cool.
We don't want to. We just want to go around to these places and kind of like maybe talk a little bit about the terror, but also just like hang out and eat food. But no one's paying us to do that right now.
But that book pitch is still out there. Like the journalist cookbook is still out there if anyone wants
to. We're ready.
I love how St. Louis got randomly thrown in there. I felt like it was...
That's not random.
No, St. Louis. St. Louis is gnarly. I mean, I love St. Louis. I have a lot of love for the city, but like St. Louis is an incredibly dangerous city.
Really?
That's wild.
If you look at murder rates across the world, like the top 10 cities, it's like Mexico, Brazil, Mexico, Brazil, Mexico, Mexico, St. Louis.
Wow.
Yeah.
I had no idea. Is that gang related? Is there a lot of organized crime there? Like, what is that?
St. Louis is just this giant coming together of every problem in America, whether it's like horrible discrimination and segregation in really poor communities, poverty, loss of jobs, opioids are a big thing there. And there's like no gun laws. Mm. So you have a poor population that's kind of closed off with no opportunities and lots of guns running around. Mm. And it just kind of adds up into this terrible situation. But there's a lot of good things there. I don't want to just completely...
Of course. Yeah. You know,
lovely, lovely city. I hope it bounces back.
Mm-hmm. Well, so tell us, friends. You've talked a lot about a variety of different mafias and organized crime groups. Your podcast specifically deals with organized crime is how you would describe what your topic is, right?
Yeah, there's some, you know, we use the word mafia as like a catch-all for just like criminal organizations, gangs. Mm. Sometimes we'll talk about just, you know, I have an episode coming up on just the city of Acapulco, how it got so dangerous. So there's some cool historical stuff brought in there, or individuals that have risen up. You know, we're getting into weird Bitcoin fraud stuff too.
But yeah, generally, yeah, that's great.
I think people prefer like the organized crime mafia stuff as opposed to the other stuff.
It's fascinating. Yeah,
it is. And it's a world that I know nothing about, which is why of the topics that we could have explored with you guys, that's the one that I'm interested in. I just like know nothing about the mafia. Endlessly fascinating, or mafias, I should say, not that there's only one mafia. And I would love to know, like, is there a common thread that you've seen on, let's just start with how mafias are formed in the first place?
Ooh, good question. All right, who's going to go first?
I think you have a good answer, man. You're a smart guy.
I mean, thank you so much. This is going to go so well. I guess there are certain elements that we always like have every episode we do. There are going to be certain like building blocks on which these kind of like groups are built. So in loads of them, you have poor communities, marginalized communities. They might be minority ethnic communities that are ignored or somehow maligned by state or some powers. And then there's, I mean, a lot of these places are on kind of like the logistical routes for certain items that people like to do. And then there's kind of like a loss of identity, I guess. There's like young, usually men, who are kind of looking for structure, purpose, reason in their lives. And they get drawn into these like paternal kind of like circles where they're like, hey, you don't have to be poor. You don't have to like do nothing with your life. You can do something worthwhile. You can join a cause. And that kind of is something that, you know, links the line between organized crime and like terror groups and these kind of organizations is like really fine when it comes to that stuff. It like gives young men with no direction and no purpose and no futures, something to kind of claw onto. And some of them become more political than others, or some of them become more kind of religiously based or anything like that, because they just kind of wrap themselves around the society that they're in.
Everything that you just said completely echoes everything that we talk about in terms of why people join cults. Like, it's such a similar thing. It's people who are experiencing some kind of difficult time in their lives or in society and are looking for structure, looking for meaning, looking for something to sort of make their life better. And it's interesting, it is mostly men, right? Like, are you aware of any female-run organized crime groups? Is that a thing?
Oh, hey, I mean, I think we have an episode coming out. Is it next week or the week after that? On a
couple of weeks, yeah.
Yeah, on a middle-aged woman in Chinatown, New York, who ended up running this huge smuggling, human trafficking, we couldn't quite figure it out, ring.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, it is male, vastly. And
yeah,
there is something to do with like the idea of masculinity that draws people into this stuff as well.
Yeah, it's a place for them to get a community that isn't really offered anywhere else.
Right, and people talk about how, like, I see people at least often talk about how cults are usually, women are usually the ones who join cults, which is a misconception. There are many, 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 many men who join cults, but it is definitely a thing that you see more, at least in the media, is women who need something in their lives. And I feel like this is sort of the flip side of that. It's just, you know, sort of branded differently because they end up doing very different things.
I guess in many ways, cults and organized crime outfits are like filling a void, like you're saying, in like people's lives, but they're also boiling identities down to a common denominator, right? So if you're going to look at like young men in a group, they'll just get boiled down to like raw masculinity, or they're like loads of these groups that we cover. They're like really nationalist and they're really like religiously zealous, or they're like really extreme. They're like quite extremist organizations. And I guess that appeals to people who don't have a lot of prospects or are struggling to cope with things in their private life that are really complex or difficult to do or to get through. And these groups kind of give them easy answers, right? That like cults give people easy answers, and so do gangs, I guess, in some sense.
I think too, it's like, you know, they, similar to cults, they provide a framework, right, for seeing the world and for how to succeed in it. You know, when you look at MS-13 and some of these other groups that come up, a lot of the people that join are lost. You know, they're looking for structure. They're looking for family, or they're young and easily influenced by people who have power,
right,
who tell them that like, there's a way to gain power. There's a way to see the world if you come with me and you do this. I mean, brainwashing might be too strong a word, but there is a way of winning them over into this group and making it seem like this is the only thing that matters, is belonging to this group. And this is what you need to do to keep belonging. And it just like, it's a cycle that keeps going and going and going.
Earlier, before we were recording, one of you mentioned recruitment methods. And I would love to know about some of the recruitment methods that you guys have seen.
I mean, something that I was reporting a couple of years ago was the Nigerian, these cult gangs that have become like really, really sort of darkly powerful in Nigerian society. And they've spread all over the world. It's like arguably one of the biggest mafias, however you want to describe it, in the world. And one of the things they do, which kind of leads on from what we were saying, is they recruit young men and increasingly now young women straight out of college, like fresh. You know, there's a lot of joblessness and it's a lot of cronyist problem there. So if you don't know the right people, you don't go to the right college. That does sound quite similar to our own countries. But you've got no chance, right? So they'll say, look, we've got this gang. I don't think most of them make any kind of bones about what they do. They're like, hey, there's a bad side, but hey, there's a good side. You know, you've got prospects. You're going to be around people that can help you out.
Right.
And they'll just like recruit people in the first year of the university degree. And then you go through this like quite grueling, embarrassing initiation ceremony. I mean, in the case of the guy that I focused on for my story, they kind of like burn you with an aerosol can and they like beat you up and they like get you really high on various drugs and stuff like this. And then like once you're in, it's kind of like, I guess, really cultish in that they, okay, you go in like layer one and you're like an inductee and you go through this process and then you go through layer two, you've got another year and then you maybe getting into the violence or the drugs and things like this. Then you go to level three and you get more respect and kind of trust from your peers.
Sounds like Scientology right now.
I couldn't stop thinking of Scientology when I was.
Can we talk about Scientology? Like, are you guys in LA? Like, are we safe to talk about that?
Yeah. Talk all the shit you want.
Thank God, because that was exactly what I was thinking.
I was like the whole time I never thought about it, but the way you're describing it, it's like, this is the way you succeed. Here are the different levels you have to reach doing like super weird stuff.
And it's outlined like that? Like it is that structured and hierarchical?
Yeah,
like
that level where you learn about that alien in the volcano where everyone's phaetons or whatever, they're flying out.
Yeah.
Like that is, for them, that would be like the international level of the group, right? So you stop just being someone who's like an ex-student in Nigeria and you start to talk to people in other parts of the world and then you do these scams that make people billions of dollars each year. Now these like, I'm a Vietnam vet and I've buried like money in a desert somewhere. Like that kind of email scam is what makes them billions and billions of dollars.
Really? That works?
Yeah, it does. I mean, you get one mark in like 10,000, you've made your whole year's money. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's really, really popular. But then you get inducted into that like international level and then it becomes a different kind of deal.
Well, then what happens?
and then you start making dollar. So then you start getting involved in like these financial scams. Increasingly, they're doing these like scams where you can kind of like take on a company email and you're like, hey, I'm Bob from accounts, bob@microsoft.com. And then you're like, hey, we need that money right now for the next transfer. And then someone from another part transfers you money, but you're not Bob from accounts. You're like a Nigerian scammer.
Wow.
And then they do like romance scams as well, where these like old men and women are like conned out of thousands of bucks from some guy pretending to be someone they've fallen in love with online. And it's like, it's all really grim.
Someone's mother, I can't remember who it is, but I know someone whose mother got scammed by someone who was pretending to be her lover and lost all her money. And it was like the saddest thing in the entire world.
Yeah, I mean, who hasn't been there?
Yeah, dude, make a podcast about it. That's the ticket right there.
I have a neighbor who thinks she's in love with John Mayer and he's in love with her as well. And nothing I
well,
can do.
Well, who doesn't think that, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
And are we sure that he doesn't love her?
We are, yes. We are positive. So
okay.
It's pretty,
so sad.
Yeah.
I don't know. When I think of like organized crime, I think of like an Italian mobster who's like selling physical things and showing up at your door if you don't do the thing. And I guess online, it makes sense that so much of it would be just email scams.
Well, actually, it's interesting that you say when you think of the mafia, you think of like Italian crime families, right? Because a massive, massive reason that these Nigerian groups have been like able to get so big is because cops in predominantly white countries just have not clocked the fact that some guys from Africa would be able to con them. And that's like one massive thing that was running through everything that I was looking at in like Europe and North America, was that these cops were like, oh, these like African guys, like they can't do anything clever. And like 10, 15, 20 years, they were just like rinsing everyone dry.
Wow. Fascinating.
Is the mafia, the Italian mafia, still like going strong in New York, or is it kind of past its heyday?
It's past its heyday. I mean, they're still out there. We have a couple episodes too about various other gangs that have come up in New York. In like the 80s and 90s, the feds really started cracking down. And you have the situation where you have newer immigrant groups that are coming in, like the Albanians, like the Vietnamese in the 80s. And we always give this qualifier, like, you know, we do a story about this Vietnamese gang or this Russian mafia gang or this Albanian gang. And we're like, most of the immigrants that come in here, like over 95% are law-abiding, amazing citizens.
Right, of course.
But those people would be boring to do a podcast about. Right. So we talk about the ones that are the criminals that are doing all this stuff. So New York's fascinating, and I want to do more on it because, you know, it's like this ever-changing pattern of immigration and ethnic enclaves. And every group that comes over, doesn't matter if Jewish, Irish, Italian, Vietnamese, Jamaican, every group is marginalized when they first get here. And because of that, they have criminal organizations that rise up because it's a product of poverty. It's a product of lack of opportunities and just sort of them being left to fend for themselves. So, you know, some people, when they're left to fend for themselves, they're going to handle things in a different way.
Do you think if societally we took care of everyone and made sure everyone was doing okay and had their health care provided for and had enough money to eat and a place to live, do you think that there would be less of this stuff?
I mean,
how much you giving them? Was
these guys that a lot of them that get involved in the life, like, aren't doing it for the basics. You know, they're not doing it to like drive a Kia. Mm-hmm. They want a little bit more than that. If we give everyone a Kia, I think there might be a lot more people that were happy.
My mom drives a Kia. It's a good car. It's a great
car. I don't want to badmouth Kias, but you know what I'm saying.
We need that Kia money flowing in.
Yeah.
I guess something that I find, and I think we both find like really fascinating about organized crime, is that it's not a subject that lends itself to easy answers, right? Like there's so many different overlapping reasons and motivations and mm-hmm. like all kinds of different stuff that's piled into this one topic. And it's not really something you can just stick a kind of easy band-aid over either. It's like, there's loads and loads of different things that you're going to have to figure out before you stop the mob.
Right. Well, when we were talking to Gerardo, our former MS-13 member, I was surprised. I guess I was expecting the sort of after school special answer, which is that like he struggled and if people weren't struggling, then they wouldn't join gangs. And that was definitely an element. And that was definitely something we talked about. But he also talked about, you know, wanting respect, power and pride and like wanting to be the big man and like sort of own the streets, which it's like partially a protective mechanism, but it partially is this other thing that's just, yeah, it's just more complicated than that, I guess.
It's the cult of toxic masculinity.
You know, there is like, you know, I've spoke to some young gang members about this, people that have left the gangs. And I remember this 16-year-old, well, he was 16 when he really got involved. He was a Crip in St. Louis. And he said one of the big reasons he got involved was because girls liked the gang members. Mm-hmm. He likened it to like wearing a varsity jacket in like the 50s.
Right.
There's a cool factor there, you know, like in a lot of places, it's not just the US thing, right? It's not just like a Crips and Bloods thing. There is a cool factor to getting involved with organized crime and crime in general. And like those dudes, you know, they get the girls.
Right. And movies contribute to this mystique, but I love it. I love movies about organized crime. I can't help it. I think it's cool.
Yeah, it does.
What, are we going to make movies about kind people who follow the
kind
rules?
Kind people are losers. Why would we make movies about kind people?
They don't make for good podcasts. Like, that's just the truth.
It's true. What do you think, both of you, what is the most fascinating to you, fascinating group that you've covered?
That's a really good question. I don't think many people have asked that ever.
Oh, God, that's a good question. Okay. I'm going to go with the Burmese stuff that I did recently. So I was out in Myanmar, Burma, I was there like a year and a half ago, covering like what is the world's biggest drug kingpin by some distance, this guy actually. And he was recently like arrested. But I think what makes these groups interesting, I guess I probably could say the Nigerians for this as well, is that if you dig into their history and you dig into like what made them big or what made them like so toxic, you're going to find out just by default almost everything you need to know about the country's recent past, because this guy had come up, like his forebears had like fought Chinese anti-communists in the jungle, and then the reason that he carved out this drug empire was because there were loads of like ethnic rebel groups in Myanmar that were fighting each other at the time. And then the generals took over. Like you can kind of like go through the country's history through this one organization.
You're telling the story so boringly.
I know.
Sean went to the jungle for like 6 weeks, multiple times in Burma to like track down this kingpin drug lord who's estimated to have like made billions of dollars. He's going to like illegal casinos and there's like endangered animals for sale and all sorts of like wild crazy. And he's just like, well, you know, the logistics of it all are very, nah, dude, tell the people what they want to hear. He was in the jungle like hunting kingpin.
Yeah, I did end up like sailing down the Mekong with some random drug dealer and sleeping on a beach. And then I've got to give a big shout out to my photographer because he literally got like attacked by a tiger in a cage and nearly died.
Whoa.
Lead with that story next
time. I've got to lead with the good stuff. Yeah, it was pretty mad. It's like all of this stuff is channeled through this one casino, and it's like a tiny island of China in the middle of Laos on the side of the Mekong River, and it's like crazy stuff, like loads of drugs. They eat snake meat, crocodile meat, tiger meat. There's all horrible stuff, underage prostitutes, illegal gambling. Mm. It's like, it's pretty dark. And from there, I was like, okay. When I went out there, my editor was like, all right, that's the story, obviously, the casino with all this like crazy Sodom and Gomorrah stuff. And then me and my photographer just got obsessed with the idea of this gigantic meth lab that this guy had and that took us into the jungle, and that took us to these like ethnic rebel groups. And by the end of it, I don't think either of us gave a toss about the casino in any way. We just wanted to see like this thing.
Wow.
And we never did. And I went back out there and I didn't see it that time either. But I like to think it was worth it when I go to bed at night. Yeah, it was pretty crazy. But like this, it was allowed to flourish because of all these historical stuff. So yeah, I guess that was like, why am I so obsessed with telling the history of this stuff? God, where do you put the good stuff?
Yeah. Have you ever felt like, oh shit, I'm about to be killed right now?
Yes.
Yeah.
Most of that was more war stuff than anything else. Just being in the wrong place at the wrong time and things happening around you. Generally, though, I'm more stressed out dealing with whether or not I can trust someone that is like a dangerous person. Because that's just like, you know, you're going to sleep at night and you know this person knows where you are and what they're capable of, but you've kind of got to be dependent on the fact that they're, you know, telling you the truth when they're saying that you're okay to be there and everything like that.
Right.
So yeah, I had a, you know, I had a situation. I was reporting in Syria early on in the war, and I was essentially living with this rebel group, these like young kids in the FSA. And it was fascinating because, you know, you hang out with these kids. I felt like I was back in college. Like these kids were, obviously there was a lot of chaos going around, but they were, you know, smoking cigarettes and staying up all night and making fun of each other. And everyone had inside jokes and they'd be playing music on their phones and all that. And you kind of come to this realization that like, this could be me and my friends if we were born into different circumstances.
Right.
Like these kids didn't will the situation into existence. They just kind of dealt with the situation they were in. But at the same time, like this Al-Qaeda faction was nearby, and I got these kids to kind of go with us to be my protection while we interviewed them. And then we left, but they kind of knew where we were. And if they wanted to come for us, like, I don't know if the guys that I was with would have risked their lives to protect me. So that's the kind of stuff that keeps you up at night. That and Ebola. Like I was doing Ebola for a while and you just don't know. Like you don't want to be the asshole who comes back to New York.
No.
And,
oh my God.
Because there was that guy and that happened right when I had gotten back. And I was like, I don't want to be on the cover of the New York Post as like, you know, schmuck reporter.
Yeah, just like peace sign. Yeah.
Yeah. Just some like idiot photo of me from Instagram where I'm like chugging three beers at the same time.
Yeah. No.
This menace to society.
In fifth grade, they made us read The Hot Zone. Did they do that to you guys?
No. That
the book about Ebola?
Traumatizing.
Yeah. It's really fucked up.
What's
anyway.
The Hot Zone?
What
I didn't
that?
Even know what
that
is.
Oh, it's a good
Me
book.
Neither. It's a really good book. It's about Ebola spreading and basically how it could kill the entire planet.
That's
advanced for a fifth grader.
Abuse.
Yeah, I mean, I wish that they had made everyone I know read that because maybe my family would have insisted on wearing masks sooner in the pandemic. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think in those situations, I feel like, and I'm definitely not saying this to big myself up at all. Like I'm clearly it's stupidity, but like if you're in the moment where you're in like a lot of danger, I don't think you realize it in that second necessarily. And then you get like a second out of it and you're like, holy shit, that was pretty stupid. There's been a few incidents like that in my reporting, but I don't know. I don't have to get stuff on film, so I'm all right. I can just sit in the corner and like write my little
notepad. Right.
I'm like, oh my God, I'm so traumatized. Danny,
what group is the most fascinating for you?
So I was going to say, actually, I mean, Sean kind of led with it, but I think it's one of our early episodes, and I did a documentary about these like human trafficking organizations in Southeast Asia that operate in like Burma and Thailand and wherever else, because I think we think of organized crime and it's, you know, guys in suits sometimes or people that are, you know, just living within society, but functioning on like a different level. These situations there, I mean, what Sean talked about and the group that I was people that I was talking about, like it's really lawless. Like there are still places in this world that are, you know, ruled by warlords where people get sold off into slavery. And these groups are really, really gnarly and scary. And I spent weeks running around Thailand and the border and Burma trying to track these guys. And then we had an interview, not an interview, like a sit down schedule with the one who was supposed to be this like head honcho. And we were trying to secretly record it just as a conversation, because they pretend that they're smugglers, which, you know, smugglers can be decent people. They get people out of bad situations. But the recording device that we were using fell apart as we were trying to secretly record this guy, and he was like, "What are you doing? You're recording me."
Okay, nope.
And then he left, and we ran through the streets of Bangkok, like looking over our shoulders, switch hotel. I mean, the thing is that we were, you know, two white guys in the middle of Thailand doing this, so there is a certain level there where like they don't want the attention that would come from murdering us. That's what we tell ourselves. But it was I mean, these places where there isn't like a framework for legality there in general. It's just like the most powerful person rules. I think are endlessly fascinating, and especially the people who rise up to the top of those places.
The people who do rise up to the top, like, what are the sort of common qualities that you've seen?
They're usually very intellectual. They usually speak a bunch of languages. Like, they're really, from my reporting, they come from like multicultural backgrounds is quite common as well, that they straddle different worlds and they kind of feel comfortable.
Interesting.
Being like wearing a suit or wearing camo gear or whatever. Like, they seem to be able to straddle a lot of different worlds, and they're quite chameleon-like in that sense. They're like acutely aware of people's incentives at all times. Like, they know who's out to get them, who they can butter up. They kind of have this like innate ability to like figure out people's motivations. But I don't want to make them sound like preternatural psychs, but they're like,
right,
they're usually like super clever, basically.
I think there's a callousness there.
Oh yeah.
That thankfully most people don't have, where they can easily compartmentalize things that they do to people that aren't their people and how they treat their people. Because a lot of these guys are family men. You know, they have kids, they have wives, and I'm sure they're lovely. Well, not all of them, but to their kids and their wives. But the things that they're willing to put other people through, maybe not they themselves, but their organizations, like, there's got to be something there where you can just turn off a part of your brain or your conscience. I would also say, like, I mean, this is another boring answer, but like logistics, like some of these guys, like what they're able to organize, you know, it's like they're like the CEO of like UPS, like the guy we just did an episode on organized, you know, the Hell's Angels taking giant amounts of weed from Western Canada to Eastern Canada, and then organized Native American smugglers and reservations that straddle the border of the US and Canada to take the same weed into the US, and then organized all these like storage units and dealers in New York.
Wow.
Got the money shipped out to California, where they used it to buy cocaine from the Sinaloa cartel, which was then shipped back to Canada, where he worked with like the Italian mafias there. And this guy was doing this before he was 30. And that is like a level of genius that, like, you're the CEO of a Fortune 500 company if things shake out differently.
Sounds stressful.
Do they want to produce my movies? Because those would be really useful skills to have.
They got to want, like, launder their money somehow. I mean, we joke about that a lot on the podcast, but we're also serious. Like, we will take your money and do things with it and make fake receipts. And I'm sure Lola will too.
I mean, the ability to compartmentalize and to, like, care about your particular group and care less about your out-group, it sounds sociopathic, but it's not actually that sociopathic, because that's kind of what we're all doing all of the time. So that's something I'm really interested in. I mean, obviously, like, you know, we're probably not ordering hits on our out-group, but it is very easy to sort of see them as not human. So I don't know. So I feel like so much of this is bred by circumstances.
It's like, are we predisposed to this kind of stuff, or is it just nurture, right? Like, so much of what we report is the peak of like identity in some way, that like, all right, I'm with my five guys. I'm going to kill you five guys. Why? Because you're not my guys. And like,
right.
That's like the almost ridiculous like end of that argument. But like, everything that we cover is the true identity politics. Like, it's actually, it's people from, usually they can identify themselves as a single group, whether it's like ethnic based, but usually like marginalized. I don't know. There's always like a sense that you are being victimized in some way. There's almost always a line in these groups that someone is screwing us over, and that's why we do it. I think we were doing an episode, we were recording yesterday, and we were talking about like these guys in former Yugoslavia, and there was like a line that they were doing it because Western Europeans were like coming down on them for so many years, right? That was the Pink Panthers line. You should talk about the Pink Panthers. They're so good.
Was that something that was true? And then just
yeah, like, yes and no, right? Their country had gone, or their area had gone through a hard time because of various situations. But the reason they got cracked down on by like Western Europe and NATO was because, you know, their leader was ordering ethnic cleansing and horrific war crimes and all that. So the whole thing was that there was a narrative out there that they were doing this to like strike back and get revenge and all that. But the real narrative is that they wanted BMWs and like diamonds and chains and to have a really nice life and jet skis and all that. Like, that's really what the motivation was. You can dress it up however you want. It's like, you know, when these sort of militant leftist groups sometimes commit bank robberies and they're like, these are reappropriations. But a lot of the time that money just goes to, you know, supporting a lifestyle or drugs or guns or things like that. And it's like, you know, you're not Robin Hood, you're just robbing.
Actually, there's a group that me and Danny have both covered that we've barely ever talked about, even between ourselves, and that's in Burundi, and that's the Imbonerakure, and that is like one of the most cult-shaped organizations that I've ever covered as a journalist, in the sense that they have this like dear leader kind of thing going on with their president, and they will like hack people up in his name. And
whoa.
I don't know, like when you were out there, did you kind of see that as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's also another thing too, where that's based off ethnic divisions, right? A lot of the times in these situations, it's people in power that play off those things to give themselves more power. And that was the situation that I was seeing in Burundi. We're just going in all sorts of directions here right now.
No, it's interesting. I like it. Yeah.
There was that element, but it's kind of like we're talking about how like it's your group and everyone else like can get it if they have to. And I agree with you, Lola, that like that's a very human thing, right? You're going to care more about what happens to your family and then your neighbor and then your neighborhood than you are about something that happens to somebody 5,000 miles away. That's just natural. I think the people that we deal with just take that like to the extreme. We're like, they really don't care. And they don't care if they do things that are harmful to those people, as long as their people and they themselves are taken care of. Another thing too, I forgot to add this. A lot of these guys at the top are just like charming.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Not all of them. Some of them are just like kind of sloppy messes, but they're like charming guys. Like they know how to problem solve. Like it really is a really important leadership quality. Like they can handle things. I wouldn't say they're calm under pressure, but they know what to do. They're decisive. They know what to do under pressure. It's like Tony. Like everyone knows Tony was like, you know, Silvio tried to be boss for like a minute and had like a heart attack.
Yeah. I mean, they sound a lot like cult leaders. And then it's also interesting how a lot of cult leaders get started in kind of a positive way, and then greed and everything takes over. And then a couple of years later, they have a giant cult. It's pretty weird.
Yeah. And like the amount of cult leaders that start off doing like petty crime and they want to like do something that's just for their own benefit. And then they end up realizing they can drag other people along with them and turn it into something for the other people that is more meaningful than it is for them. I think that is something that like combines these two worlds a little bit. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
I'm just endlessly fascinated by the idea, the perceived victimization, there is truth in it. And it makes sense. Like it is natural to want to fight against whatever victimization you've been experiencing. But then at what point are you just now victimizing other people and no longer the,
I mean, that's where the morality becomes really hard, right? Because like I live in Berlin, right? And a lot of the organized crime is kind of run by these Turkish, Kurd, Lebanese families. And it's almost entirely run by these guys, right? So that lends a sort of voice to the sort of far right who say, oh, hey, these guys are bringing over organized crime. They're causing problems. But actually, when you dig into it, obviously, it's a lot more like complex than that. And these families that came over at the end of the war, they were never given citizenship. They couldn't send their kids through the proper like schooling systems. They didn't really have a future. Like, why would you play ball with a society that doesn't like give you the same rights as other people, right? And the addition to that is like, well, that doesn't really justify them bringing heroin over from Turkey. But, you know, like it's how do you want to stop this stuff? And you have to realize that the origins of this stuff might be identity and like gang related, but the solutions are not. The solutions are systemic. And if you give everyone an even playing field, you know, maybe you will give people a chance to play a part in your society. God, I'm getting up on my soapbox now. Quick, stop me.
No, I stay up there.
Cool, yeah. We've looked at countless groups that are like this, that have the same background. I mean, Danny did an episode on Russian gangsters in Brighton Beach, New York. It's the same thing, right? I mean, they've been chased out of their own country, whether they're Jewish or whether they're standing up to the government in some way. Mm-hmm. They've left the Soviet Union. They come over to the US. They can't speak the language. They're not
right.
They're not like getting the same help. And like this stuff is gonna happen. Like that's gonna be the outcome of that. So you don't have to give the solution an identity. You just have to give it a systemic like answer in some way. You have to improve the system.
Right. All right. If you had to choose which group to join yourselves, which one would it be?
That's a good one. The Pink Panthers seem like they're having a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You know, they don't really hurt anyone besides maybe punching a few old jewel clerks or
Wait, which group? Which group?
The Pink Panthers are this group of like guys from the former Yugoslavia that do really high level heists.
Now you're burying the lead because they robbed Kim Kardashian at gunpoint.
No, they didn't rob Kim Kardashian. They thought that it was them who robbed Kim Kardashian.
Yeah.
It was a bunch of old guys that were between the ages of 60 and 70 called the Grandpa Robbers. And one guy wrote a book before he went on trial called I Robbed Kim Kardashian. That was the title of the book.
So, that'll stop. Do it. The Grandpa Robbers, is that true?
This is true. There was she got robbed, I think, in Paris in 2016.
I remember
it
that.
It was during Fashion Week.
Yeah.
And they had like terrible security. We always say, like, one of our catchphrases is don't Instagram your crimes, right? Because a lot of people get caught literally by Instagramming the crimes that they've committed or the things they've gotten from committing those crimes. And like law enforcement knows that now. So that's a big thing that we always remind our listeners, if they're committing crimes, don't Instagram them. But, you know, people like Kim K and others, really popular rappers, will Instagram like their locations and the large amounts of money and jewelry that they have on them. So Kim did that. And these guys were like, well, she's got $10 million worth of jewelry. Why don't we take it from her? You know, knew the hotel she was in. They had no security and they tied her up and took all her jewelry. People thought it was the Pink Panthers, but it was really this group of old men that the French press termed the Grandpa Robbers. And they went and they took everything that she had. And I don't think maybe a few got away, but they escaped. They literally escaped on bicycles. It's like the
bicycles.
Most European thing. The most European thing ever.
Adorable.
Yeah. There needs to be a movie. Tony Shalhoub, like, cast him in the starring role.
One of the reasons I found out a lot of information when I was in Myanmar, I literally searched for the hashtags of this casino in like IG and found loads of like random drug dealers and like weird casino dwellers. And that was how like we found a bunch of the people at this casino that were doing really dodgy stuff. And there was this Chinese word that meant like forbidden meat or something that basically meant you could go to the store and order like a lion. And then we just like typed that into IG in English and it came up with like these restaurants that were pretending they weren't doing anything.
Wow.
So do not Instagram. Amazing. Your friends. Yeah. The journalists will find you as well.
Everyone has those friends that are like a little messy on Instagram and put too much of their life out there. But there's people doing that with like the like enormous amount of felonies that they're committing and then getting arrested for it. Like people are messy on Instagram.
On the much milder side, height of the pandemic, people Instagramming being at crowded parties without masks was wild.
Yeah. A lot of that too.
Yeah.
Why are you putting that on display, my friends? But the Pink Panthers, you would join because
they just seem like they're having a lot of fun. You know, they're like robbing jewelry stores in Monaco or like in Saint-Tropez. You know, they don't really hurt people that much. They're said to be like, you know, guys who wear suits and speak five languages and they're kind of slick.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're robbing jewelry stores, like high level jewelry stores. Like,
yeah, it's Ocean's 11. It's
right.
Fine. It's
as
fun.
Far as, I'm not saying it's a victimless crime, but it's not like you're hurting average people. I don't know. They seem like they're having a good time.
Maybe the business owners.
They did a getaway on speedboats. Like, that's kind of cool.
That's cool.
Yeah. I'd just go with any of the guys like dealing pot because who gives a shit about pot anyway? And it's probably all going to be legal all over the whole world in a few short years. So I'll go with that. But the Pink Panthers are way cooler.
They have a good time. I just imagine them like wearing a lot of linen, you know.
Of course.
Yeah,
really nice sunglasses.
Lots of, like,
sitting at a cafe somewhere in
they
the south of
France. They smell so good. I can smell them, and it's so yummy. Yeah,
oh yeah.
I would join the most dangerous, awful one. Just kidding.
We joke about that too. If like things with journalism don't pan out, the next thing you do is go into PR and cartels. Ooh. Like cartels need, you know, they're always leaving those misspelled banners over highway right. overpasses, trying to make an impression, cutting off people's heads. And it's like, why has no one thought to cut off someone's feet? Like that'll help you stand off, you know, stand out.
Right.
And I think, so I think that's another.
Yeah, syntax is really lacking in the yeah. world.
What has your experience been or whatever with people who try to leave and like, are they not allowed to leave? Is it very difficult to
yeah.
leave?
That's a good question. I mean, you guys had the I forget his name, but the MS-13 guy talk about that a lot. And that's a really scary one. I actually did a documentary about people trying to leave these groups in El Salvador, MS-13 and 18th Street. And the only way that you're actually allowed to do it is by becoming born again in the evangelical church. For some reason, that's like the one method. So you have a lot of people, you know, I was hanging out with these guys who live in like a sort of like a halfway home where they have a church in the home. And there's a guy who was a former 18th Street member there who oversees everything. And it's kind of like the gang leaders accept this because evangelical Christianity has such a big presence there. And there's some sort of deal there. There's always been a respect for religious figures in that world, which is weird. But the gang members that leave have to really abide by it. Like if they see you out at night, if you say you left the gang to become a born again and they see you out at night and you're smoking weed and drinking beers and hitting on women, like they'll kill you.
Wow. Fascinating.
But there are these organizations now of evangelical leaders that work to pull gang members out that want to leave.
Yeah. The guy that was my main contact with the Nigerian groups was like, he was in fear of his life all the time. Mm. You don't leave. There's like an apocryphal tale that if you leave, they have to cut off your thumb with like a pocket knife or something, but even that's just like BS, and basically you can't leave. So anyone that like gets out of the group, I mean, they don't. So yeah, it's like so ingrained.
Wow. So you don't leave, but if someone did try to leave, what would happen?
Oh, they're dead. Yeah, they would get killed in the street for sure, 100%.
And if they made it out of the country, would someone follow them, or would they be safe?
Yep.
They would be followed.
Yeah. Especially in the case of them. I mean, it's just like, there's been so many incidents of guys getting whacked on foreign soil from the Nigerian mob. They'll find you. They're in every country. There's like a cell of this, the Black Axe, the one main group that I followed, that was like, they had a Venezuela cell. They have like a Zambia cell. Like they're everywhere. They're wow. like absolutely everywhere. Yeah, ugh, they'll find you.
That's so terrifying and sad.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't get involved in the first place.
Yeah, no, ideally.
No.
Can you not join the group if you're sort of in their territory or?
It depends. It kind of depends who you speak to, right? So you'll speak to someone. This is the thing about these groups that some people say they're nothing, right? And they're just kind of like street thugs who are going around doing petty crimes. And there are others who say they run the country and they run every level of the country from your corner boys in Lagos to the president. Mm. And it's like, I would actually believe the latter because they've had loads of people who've had affiliations with these groups. So you cannot get out of them, and they just have turf wars, the same as any other gang. So like they'll kind of run different cities from one day to the next. Mm. There's like 6 or 7 big groups like this in Nigeria. And I mean, it's a gigantic country, actually not compared to the States, but like, I think it's like 200 million people. Like 1 in every 6 African is a Nigerian. So this is a huge country. I mean, Lagos is like 20 million people. And these gangs are like everywhere. And they used to be done only by students coming out of university that would be young men. And now it's young women, young boys. Some guys I was speaking to at a university in the south of the country, they said they were getting like stuck up by boys who were like 10,
oh,
I think
my
it
God.
Was. So there's like just everyone's involved in this. There's no kind of a direction to stop it because the politicians are involved and they use them as hide muscle. Mm. So it's kind of like, where do you even begin dismantling it? So it's a very long way of saying, yeah, you're pretty much screwed, and they do run a lot of the stuff there. And now there's whole cities in Europe that are pretty much run by the group as well. As in Palermo, Sicily, they've like outrun the mob. Like they've outrun the Sicilian mafia in Sicily, which is crazy.
Wow.
Yeah. And they're all over like Germany, Spain. Yeah. It's crazy. Mm.
Wow. It's just so doubly devastating when it's kids. I mean, I think, you know, I'm always surprised at how young people are who end up in gangs, like, because in my head it's grown-ups, but it's like so often teenagers. But especially when they're that young, I'm like, what option? Mm. Like, that is not a person who's able to make decisions for themselves, and there's just not a lot of freedom there, and it's the lost childhood, and it makes me really sad.
That's the callousness, right?
Yeah,
they don't care.
So do you guys have any final thoughts? I know we specifically said that there is no simple answer, but if you could sort of, you know, crystallize like a very, very oversimplified idea of what a solution could be, do you have one? Is that just too ridiculous an ask?
I would say that always bear in mind that however you run your society, people will look for the best way to give themselves a better life. So if you don't give it to them, they'll do it themselves. Is that too threatening? That sounds really like you're threatening.
No.
That sounds so threatening. Especially as a Brit talking to Americans.
It rings true,
We're getting that land back.
I don't have a solution in mind, but I would just say that, you know, one of the things we try to stress, because we focus on different groups from different places and different ethnicities, is that there's really no, it's not like one ethnicity or culture or whatever is more drawn to this, right? Everyone is just a product of their environment and their circumstances. And we go into a lot of actually historical stuff about why, you know, these sort of groups and people rise up in certain areas. And that's kind of the takeaway that I think we try to drive home, is that, like, you know, you see a lot of, we put our stuff up on YouTube, and there's a lot of, you know, YouTubers and their comments. It's not the nicest way of viewing the world or people that are different from them. And I think one thing we always try to stress is that, like, that's really not the case. Like, no culture, no people, no race is predisposed to this sort of thing. People right. are products of their environment.
Mm-hmm. 100% agree. And, you know, we talked a little bit about how there's an element of just like wanting to be cool, but the historical element is a really, really huge part of the story that I feel like.
It's like a massive part of what we want to get across in our podcast as well. Because, like, I think one thing that drove us at the beginning was that there are so many shows that, like, hey, look at this drug kingpin. And then they just don't really go into like the reason why these people even exist. And I think because we're so used to doing documentaries and feature writing and stuff like this, where you like, you have to tell that story. There's no point telling the story if you don't learn the kind of building blocks behind these phenomenon. So we really want to get that across. And I think it's like super important too.
Yeah, I agree. We are all products of our environment. And as we always say on this podcast, nobody is exempt. We like to think that we are because it makes us feel safe, but we are not. All right. Any final thoughts that you guys have? Do you have social media you want to share?
Yeah. The Underworld Podcast is our podcast. You can search for it anywhere on iTunes, Spotify. We have like an Instagram account, a Twitter. I think we have a Patreon too, where we do bonus interviews, which is patreon.com/theunderworldpodcast. We want to thank you guys too, because this was great. And thank you so much for helping us get the word out there and talking to us and everything like that. It was really fun.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on. All right, Megan.
Yeah.
All righty. So here's the question today.
All right, I'm ready.
I don't have a specific group, but I'm going to just generally ask you, do you think that you would join the mafia, a mafia?
Oh, man. I mean, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Why?
She says,
for sure.
If I was raised in a place where it was dangerous and it was like, this will protect you, this is loyal family thing to do, I'd be like, yeah, heck yeah. Especially if I was younger when that happened. And then I just think, you know, being born into things or needing the protection are two very primal things that I'm not one of those people who's willing to like fight.
You're not a rebel. She's not a rebel fighter.
I guess I'm just saying, like, I wouldn't want to die some horrific mob death. So if they're like, you're in the mob now, I'd be like, cool, let's have some mob meetings then, I guess. Yeah.
Wow, you don't want to die? Weird. So unusual. Yeah, I mean, I joined the mob. If I was, you know, in a situation where that seemed like the way to be safe, of course I would join the mob.
Yeah.
The other point that I would make here is I'm going to go back to the women mob thing. Because they mentioned that there's a female mob leader, but like, can you even, it's funny, like you can't even imagine, or at least I can't even imagine, a mafia that is not run by like one woman, but is like fully women, the way that mafias are like fully men. Imagine that.
I'm trying.
What would happen?
What is the difference between the mafia and a gang?
I feel like there isn't one. I feel like it's just higher, bigger crimes. Like,
okay.
Right. Gangs are more like street crimes and mafias are more like international or like more organized crime.
Right.
This is my guess. Someone could tell me that this is not the way they're defined, but that's my impression.
Yeah. The all women mafia, all women gangs. Those are so fascinating to me. I would love to talk to somebody that was in one of those.
I mean, I don't think that they exist, but I would also love to.
I know.
To.
Well, there have
gonna,
to
I'm
somewhere.
I'm going to Google it right now. All women mafia. No, these are just like, what, it's like one cocaine trafficker or someone's mafia wife. Men just love to be committing crimes. Really what it comes down to.
Have you ever seen Mickey Blue Eyes?
Oh my God. Can I tell you? That was literally, I called that movie my favorite movie when I was 13 years old.
Loved it.
It's got Hugh Grant, everyone. It's very charming.
That woman, she's like 90 years old, and she's like, my father recently died and left me a lot of money. And he's like,
no. I don't remember anything from that movie, but I loved it. I fucking
really
loved
fucking
it.
Funny. Yeah, that was my, like, that's my main mafia reference. So I'm probably a little behind.
I actually have not seen The Godfather or Scarface or any of the gang mafia movies. So I'm with you. That is no, I've seen The Sopranos. I've seen The Sopranos.
Oh, OK. You're love safe. I haven't. So if anybody out there would love to see a delightful Notting Hill-esque Hugh Grant movie, Mickey Blue Eyes is hilarious. And yeah.
Great work, everyone.
We did it.
So you can follow me, Lola, on Instagram at Ula Lola, OOHLALOLA, and on Twitter at Ola Lola, OHLALOLA.
And you can follow me at Five Higher Bitch.
And you can follow Trust Me on Instagram at Trust Me Podcast and on Twitter at Trust Me Cult Pod. And our website is trustmepod.com. Okay, everybody.
That is right. So remember this week, follow your gut, watch out for red flags, and never,
ever. Trust me.
Bye.